We are back. It is season 6, and Dan and I were just talking about Brexit.
It's the most exciting. Honestly, Brexit is, I mean, I can't even describe to you how it's like a soft, gentle feeling when we talk about Brexit.
What do you mean? What? Because it makes because Americans look less like on their own in the craziness.
It's just 15 seconds. I don't have to think about the the fire, the hellfire that I live in the United States of America.
So yeah, dude, I mean, because people keep asking me, people from abroad keep being like, Naz, explain this Brexit situation, and it's I don't freaking know. Like, it changes.
Yeah, it changes literally every day. We're gonna do a no plan, we're not gonna do a no plan. You're gonna do a no plan whether you like it or not. No, we voted against a not no plan. Well then we need a plan. Well, too bad, because there's no plan.
Well, the thing is, this is like, and we will have an episode kind of about this. This is like a Englishman who went to boarding school's problem, which is not just a theory I have. There has been a ton written about this, that like all these like posh English guys in Parliament who went to boarding schools get messed up. Anyway, so
do you guys also have an Illuminati in England?
Oh, dude. So this is The Gentle. I am Naz.
I'm Dan. So glad you're here. We have a really, I don't want to say fun episode. It's a fun episode.
It's a new season. Wait, it's a new season. It's season 6. And
we have a fun season.
And Dan has been doing a ton of interviews. You spoke to Liz Plank for like 400 hours.
That was a long time.
We're gonna hear from that. We've got a bunch of stuff coming up. This episode is going to be interesting because we are speaking to the author Jeannie Venasco, and she has just put out a book called Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl, and she interviews her rapist. So when she was in her late teens, a very close friend of hers raped her, and she tracks him down and interviews him. And so, Dan, you had a chat with her, and whoa, that was, I feel like so many questions. Yeah. That was super interesting. So we're going to come to that. But write to us about this episode, because we're definitely going to do a follow-up. So write to us. It's thegendernot@gmail.com. Also, we are doing a follow-up on the apologies episode, and that is another big topic. So write to us about that.
Yeah. This episode also is going to talk a little bit about apologies, so you can write about both of those things.
Yeah. Also, spread the word if you like the show. Send it. People.
Three people now. I'm up in it. It used to be two. I want you to share this with three, and I want you to hand share it with them. I want you to put it on a thumb drive and hand it to someone.
You know, someone might be more willing. I feel like these days, if someone physically gives me something, I'm more willing to check it out, because it's like, oh, they had to make an effort rather than just like forward something to me, you know?
We should put this show out on cassette. And just like leave it at like weird art house coffee shops and stuff.
Oh God. That sounds fantastic and awful.
And just be like, people be like, whoa, The Gender Knot now on cassette.
Yeah, but it would attract the most annoying audience. Like, let's be real about that. But speaking of Brexit and like no one knowing what's happened, I have been super impressed by these congresswomen in your country who were like raking Mark Zuckerberg. Like, I've just been having such a good time the past few days.
Yeah, man.
Not just AOC, but like Maxine Waters and like Katie Porter and like several of them.
They just went out and stuck it to the Zuck, dude. It was
just
great.
So good. And it's just like, there's something about women schooling this dude. It's just like, oh my God, I want them to come and school Boris. I really want them to school Boris. I feel like Maxine Waters versus Boris Johnson would be like...
This could be like a new kind of porn. Do you know what I mean? Just like powerful women just shutting men down.
I mean, I was actually going to say this is like the new celebrity death match. But
that works too. But hold on, you wanted to plug a thing, right?
Yes, I want to plug a wicked app, which is called the Grace Digital Founders Campus. So it is for women who want to set up businesses. So all you ladies out there who want to set up businesses, this is a wicked app that basically it kind of guides you through everything you need to know to set up a business. So stuff from talks from founders, them giving their advice, you know, Q&As with people who founded companies. There's going to be loads of tutorials and how-tos about just like the step-by-step stuff you need to do. There'll be business-related templates. There's opportunities for mentorship. So all of this is going to be in this app. And to make it real, you need to support their Kickstarter. So we have put that in the show notes. And yeah, they've got like just lots of really good perks as well. So like, you know, you can give money to be able to like use the app once it's out, and lots of other great stuff. And so basically the concept is that a lot of female founded businesses actually do really well, but women often don't start businesses because, you know, there's a lot of talk dissuading women from starting businesses, or they have certain challenges that aren't addressed very well. So this app is going to overcome all of that, and it sounds pretty good. I have pledged, and I'm looking forward to using it once it gets up and running. So yeah.
What kind of business are you going to start?
Well, I'm always empire building. You know that.
That's true. Do you want to move to Oregon and open a coffee shop with me?
Oh, God. Is that what you're going to do? And leave cassettes everywhere?
Just cassettes of our show.
I don't know how good of a business plan that is. Maybe we can run it through the app and see.
That's why most businesses fail, is because it's some weirdo like me going, I'm going to put podcasts on cassettes and change the world, man. And then they wake up in their parents' basement 2 years later wondering how they got there.
Yeah, but you know, I often think about Jack White, who I have very mixed feelings about.
Sure, don't we all?
Because Jack White, like, I think he's amazing and he's also a psychopath. So it's just, I have really, really conflicted feelings about him. And I'm also like, he makes the most spiritual and sexual music of our generation. And yet he is also like a robot. Anyway, I have very conflicted views about Jack White. Why am I talking about him? Oh, yeah, because like he was like big in the whole sort of vinyl resurgence and in the whole analog thing. And so he's kind of like done it really well. I'm always very impressed, but and like, you know, like
he like makes guitars out of like scrap metal and shoestrings and shit.
Exactly. But also like Third Man Records is like a physical shop in Nashville, and they do like a lot of things that are not really with our times. So I don't know, maybe it's like the right person with the right idea. I don't know. But anyway,
so you're saying I should move to Oregon and open a coffee shop where it's going to be on the Oregon coast. So we also got to sell taffy. It's a tourist thing.
I don't know if you're enough of like a cold-hearted, weird person like Jack.
Ask any number of my exes and they'll disagree with you.
Oh, dude. Well, listen to this. This is really going off topic, but I read this one profile of him where, you know, this reporter had gone to his house in Nashville. It was this really old-fashioned house, and they could hear the rain really loud in the house. And something like he said that he had a speaker system outside which would amplify the sound of the rain inside the house, but he could control it. And he said something like, it's so that my children know that I can control the weather. And I was like, oh my God, this guy is like, I don't even know what to say to that.
Could you imagine being Jack White's child?
No, but you should give money to the Grace Digital Founders Campus app so that, you know, we all know how
so
to set up
we
good
stop
businesses.
Talking about Jack White.
And so that we can set up businesses which actually don't fail and which are good.
Hell yeah.
So this week's episode, you had a chat with Jeannie Vanasco. She wrote Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl. So basically it's a memoir and it's about a friendship that ended in a rape. So like I was saying before, in her late teens, a really close friend of hers raped her. So we're talking like childhood friends, someone where like they lived in the same community, they knew each other's families, like that kind of, you know, that kind of teenage friendship you have. And she gets in touch with him about 14 years or so afterwards because the rape is still affecting her. And she wants to interview him and she tells him that I want to write this as a book. So she uses a different name for him. And so the book is about that. I've been reading it. It's really, really interesting. And you and her had a massive chat.
Yeah, there was a lot to take away from it. You know, I think normally we try to like cut our interviews down a little bit, but this one I think we're leaving particularly long because there's just so much that we talked about and got into, especially with things that I just didn't see coming, which I don't know if I want to spoil too much of it up top, but like right out of the gate, she brought up this urge that she had to kind of sympathize with him.
Console him when he was like apologizing.
Yeah. Right. And that, honestly, that was a really big surprise for me.
Well, it was interesting because this interview, like, I had so many thoughts and it brought up so much for me. It's interesting that part because it made me think of our apologies episode, and because I and we've had a bit of mail about this, because I was saying that I'm not interested in guys apologizing to me, and when she was saying that, I was like, yeah, this is exactly what happens, because, you know, a guy like feels bad about what he did, and then you spent all the time trying to console them, being like, no, you know, don't feel bad. And then also because he kept saying, Jeannie talks about this, so I won't say too much, but he kept saying that, like, oh, I'm such a bad person, and she's having to console him that, no, you're not a bad person. And I've been in this position before, right, where, so, you know, someone's done something really bad, a guy, and they've come to, like, give me an apology. And, you know, when they do the whole, like, I'm such a bad person, and sometimes I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, dude, you're not great. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, what is the response to that? Like, I don't know.
It's hard. That's a hard response, right? Because it often feels to me when somebody's saying something like that, it's like when somebody gets a haircut and they won't stop like touching their hair until you go, oh, did you get a haircut? Do you know what I mean? It's a very similar thing where they're I don't know the term for it, but they're digging for it. That's what it is. They're digging for validation almost, right? Like, you're not a bad person. Look at you. You're apologizing right now. That takes a big, strong boy.
I feel like we should do like a complete episode on just how to have these conversations.
Yeah. She and I talked a little bit about that, but I think there's a lot more that you and I can do to get into that as well, especially if anyone listening has ideas on how to have these conversations. We, again, would love to hear that.
Or experiences. So definitely write to us, because we're going to come back to this topic. It's thegendernot@gmail.com. Yeah. So, yeah, here it is.
14 years after my best friend sexually assaulted me, I contacted him and I wanted to see if the sexual assault, the rape, if it mattered to him, if he still thought about it. I wanted to believe that remorse existed. So the book is it's my exploration, my thinking through my thoughts and feelings about what happened, thinking about the definition of rape and how that changed in the United States. And also it includes transcripts of my conversations with him. And after I kind of wrote the book in real time, so then after I would transcribe some of the audio, I would stop because some of it was kind of upsetting, or sometimes it was very upsetting to see how reassuring or comforting I was to him, which I was not expecting to be. And then so the transcripts are broken apart by my reflection on the conversation, my conversations with female friends who read the transcripts and gave me advice. So yeah, it's an exploration of what happened and can a good person commit a terrible act? And he isn't one of these guys who held a lot of power, right? Like a lot of the Me Too stories I was encountering, and I'm such a big supporter of the Me Too movement, but a lot of the stories I was encountering were of powerful men, like Harvey Weinstein, right? And Donald Trump and all these other, Matt Lauer, all these, a lot of celebrities in the States. And I thought, but a lot of the people who are committing these acts are regular, seemingly nice guys. And I wanted to show some attention, shine the light on these nice guys who commit rape.
That's an interesting phrase. Nice guys who commit rape. That's what you should have called your book. You said something that I want to kind of dive into. You said that you found yourself comforting him, or seeming comforting to him. Could you elaborate on that? Like, what do you mean? Like, you were kind of, I don't want to assume what you mean by that. I could hear that a few different ways.
Yeah, sure. So before we went into the conversation, I thought, okay, I am not going to be nice to him. I'm not going to worry about his feelings and look after his emotions. I'm going to tell him how he harmed me, and I want him to explain himself. I was interested in this idea of holding him accountable morally, because I never held him accountable legally for a lot of, I think, complicated reasons and a lot of reasons why a lot of women don't hold their rapists accountable legally. And what I noticed in listening to the audio recordings is how quickly I would slip into, he said early on, he's like, "I'm so sorry." And I immediately caught it. I was like, "Oh no, it's okay. It's okay. Like, we've talked about it." And I did that a lot, like really worrying about his emotions, and that I became so frustrated. And there's a lot I definitely wanted to delete from the manuscript because it gets almost redundant how much I was, you know, comforting him and saying like, "No, I know you're a good person," and it was just one night and all this stuff. I couldn't believe how much I did it. But I don't think I'm alone. And so that's why I wanted to include examples of me slipping into, I mean, it sounds a little, I'm going to get a little academic here, but the theorist Judith Butler, she has this term, performance of gender, or gender performance, and how often we slip into these behaviors that they don't feel like a performance. They feel genuine when they're happening, but they're often the result of social conditioning. And so I think I was so worried about him being uncomfortable. It felt natural at the time to constantly say like, "Oh no, I know you're a good person. I know you feel bad," et cetera. But then looking back and seeing myself, listening to myself do that, I understood Judith Butler in a way I had trouble understanding her before.
Man, that's wild. How did he react when you would say things like that?
He had trouble with it. He would say, "Well, I appreciate that, but he doesn't see himself as a good person." In fact, what I discovered in talking with him was actually very sad. I think the book would be different if he had become some conventionally successful guy. But in fact, he has a low-paying job, not great health insurance. He has scoliosis. He's 35 years old. He's still a virgin. And he's never been in a relationship, and he doesn't have friends. And he said the rape led him to no longer trust himself with women. Like, before that, he thought he was one of the good guys. And that was no longer a fiction he could maintain after that. And so, like, getting at that concept of emotional labor, I think that's interesting because as a professor, someone who teaches memoir, I hear a lot of stories, like, every semester from students who've been raped, and listening to them talk about why they didn't turn in their perpetrator or why they didn't really tell anyone. It's interesting. I recognize so much of their logic and so much of their reasoning as that's what I went through and some of what I still went through and thinking about what had happened to me and why I protected. I call him Mark in the book. I do change his name. And so I end up actually doing, not that I don't want students to feel they can open up to me, but I end up doing so much emotional labor where I'll have a line of students outside my office. I bought a white noise machine for my office so students could cry there and not, you know, people in the hallway not be able to hear them.
It's also good so you can cry there if you need to.
I did have to do that actually after the Kavanaugh hearings. Yeah, it's just the emotional labor. It's a lot because while students were lining up and crying in my office, there was a colleague down the hall who was playing the guitar in his office. Like, no one was waiting to see him. And he's a nice guy. Like, he cares about these issues. But a lot of when news stories like this come out, I think a lot of certainly students go to female faculty and especially like female faculty of color. And I think a lot of the emotional work falls on them for some of these issues. So I think it's important that men express interest in that they care about the issues and they are willing to talk and are not like shying away from these subjects. Because I think a lot of men do care and would like to see things improve, but they don't necessarily give off the comforting vibe. So a lot of the work then falls back on women.
Especially if they look anything like any man period. Like, I mean, if you just look like a man, it's not comforting at a time like that.
Sure.
Regardless, because when you go to the what you said earlier of like he doesn't look like a rapist, it's like, well, he's a man, so that's most of them. I don't. So, what do you think as for our male listeners, like, what do you think would be a way to let people know? I mean, obviously, without wearing a T-shirt that says like Brett Kavanaugh is a rapist or something like that. Like, what do you think I could just do in my day-to-day life to let people know that I am a place that's safe and comfortable to talk about those things?
I don't know, just the day-to-day stuff. You hear a sexist joke, shut it down. Or there's something in the news, bring it, see if someone wants to talk about it or express, I don't know, I'm not on social media, but like a social media post about it, or I don't know, like just something that shows that you care and are following these news items and that you're open to the discussion. Because I've noticed some men, when they hear about my book, it's interesting. There are different responses. I mean, I'm friends with a lot of like very progressive, open-minded writers, so they're fine talking about it. In fact, one guy, when I told him the subject of the book, he told me his brother had raped someone, and he talked with me about how hard that was for him. Because he's like, you know, I still love my brother. He's my brother. But there's not a day that doesn't go by that I don't think about the fact he raped someone. And so it was really wonderful to have talk about the book with men and then express interest and not like treat me with kid gloves, like treat me like an adult who can talk about these things and I'm not going to fall apart. But I think some men, it's hard if they want to, they don't want to talk about these subjects because they're afraid of saying the wrong thing. And I think if you show empathy and interest and that it's all coming from a place where you care and you're willing to listen. I think that's incredibly valuable. I think more men could do that.
A good rule of thumb is if you're afraid of saying the wrong thing, just try to say less and like listen more, right? You know what I mean? Like when something like that happens, how do just normal dudes who like care about stuff, like, I don't know, get involved in the conversation?
I don't know. What do you have? What do you think? I mean, do you have a certain...
I do a podcast. Like, that's how I do. You know what I mean? I don't know. I've accidentally, like, fallen into a place where my gifts in life and my personality traits have put me in a place where I happen to just have these conversations fairly publicly, and then that helps me really translate it to a place where I have very good female friends who know that I'm like a trustworthy person and can talk to, like, I'm the kind of person that can have these one-on-one instead of just into a microphone. So I don't really know what it would be like as a dude who's not me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it's like for a guy who doesn't have a gender podcast.
I think it would be great if the men, if guys could strategize among themselves too, you know, like just to talk out, do they have ideas? Not that I don't mind thinking about suggestions of what to do, but I think talking to, certainly mentoring and talking to younger boys, right? Because that's where some of it starts. Like, a lot of people are not getting an education about sexual assault and rape until they get to college, and usually it's in the context of, here, watch this hour-long tutorial, take a quiz, and then great, you got sexual assault training.
It's like a food handler's permit.
Yeah. And so I think it would be fantastic if we could talk about, find ways, I mean, there are people who are trained in this, right? But find ways to talk about ideas of consent, maybe not sexual consent, but just consent with kids in grade school. You know, I often think like, oh, things are going to get better. Like, young people are so passionate about climate change and all these issues. And then I was recently in DC and I saw like a busload of boys. I think they were Boy Scouts or something. And they were all wearing Make America Great Again hats. And I mean, these were kids, they looked like, I don't know, 11 and 12.
Oh yeah, that's the new Boy Scout hat. They changed it. They changed it from the green one with the tree to that.
They get like a badge.
They get a badge for making America great again.
And so then I get really, you know, I get sad because I think, oh, do I do maybe live in this bubble? So I think finding ways to talk to younger men. I mean, that's a big thing men could do.
Right on. I like that. I like that a lot. And so then flipping the coin, what can women be doing? And this is like one of the, I don't want to ask that question as if anything that women are doing presently is wrong. Do you know what I mean? But I like to personally, when I'm doing anything in life, even succeeding, failing, whatever, I ask myself, what can I be doing better? How can I be right better? So how can women be better in this situation? Like, what can y'all be doing?
Something women can do is just be open to listening to other women and not judging them for how they, you know, behaved or didn't behave. I mean, I think just people, regardless of gender identity, not rushing to judge one another and listening. I don't know. It's also, I'm not on social media, but I think there is what I'm noticing and talking to people, there is this culture of wanting to shut down discussions. Like, that's not the right point of view. So end of discussion. And in writing this book, I wanted to get to a place that was uncomfortable.
Yeah. May I ask, was this the first time you'd spoken with him since?
No. We had, so shortly after it happened, he called me either, I don't know, 2 or 3 days later and apologized. And I very quickly said, oh, no, that's fine. Everybody makes mistakes. And I told him I forgave him. But it wasn't real forgiveness, I realized, in writing this book, because I didn't let myself feel any of the, quote, negative emotions. I didn't let myself feel anger or contempt or, I don't know, rage or whatever. And so there were no emotions I was working through. It was sort of like Dr. Phil forgiveness, just like forgive in order to personally feel better. Mm-hmm. But I just rushed past it. And so
gave it the old boys will be boys and you moved on with your life.
Yes. And then a few times after that, maybe, or 2 times after that, maybe we saw one another, but in the context of larger groups. And then I just didn't talk to him again. The friendship died away. And I would hear about him over the years. Like, I heard he dropped out of college. He'd always been an incredibly smart guy. But I heard he dropped out of college and became a mechanic for a while, and was doing taxes and living at home with his parents. And I would hear updates from my mom, but she didn't know what happened. I hadn't told her. And she knows now. She does know now. She does know now. Yes. I gave her a copy of the book. I didn't tell her while I was working on it. And then I gave her a copy of the book, and she became very angry. Right. She wanted to send his parents a copy of the book, and she made a point. I got really mad at her at the time for this. I didn't tell her I got mad. I just sat there calmly while she went through her emotions and crying, and I was trying to comfort her and tell her she was a good mother and it wasn't her fault. But she said something to the effect of, you know, why do I have to know? And they don't, what his parents don't. I was mad about that at first, because I thought, well, of course she lives with me. We had turned the basement into an apartment for her. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, you were going to find out eventually. I was like, mom, you would have been furious if you had gone to the library, the bookstore, and seen this. And then I didn't tell you. She's not on social media. She doesn't really know how to use the internet. She recently asked me if Amazon sells books. So, I mean, she's like, there's a way in which she maybe might not have heard about the book. But I, you know, worried her friends would tell her. And I was like, of course, like, I was going to tell you. And she made the point, why do his parents not have to know? And she wanted to send them a book. And I said, I would prefer that you not. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to, you know, say you can't. It's your decision. But I would prefer that you read the book first and then cool off and think about it. And after reading the book, it was interesting. She was so supportive, and She said, well, I wouldn't want to do that to his parents. You know, it ends up falling back on the survivors and sometimes the survivor's support system or family of like all this emotional work and protecting him from his parents' judgment. And but I want him to tell his parents. Like if he's going to, I don't want to be, it's up to him. That would be a legitimate apology. Like he told me, he confirmed his memory of that night. He told me what he was doing was wrong. He said, I knew what I was doing was wrong while I was doing it, but I did it anyway. So he, I think, was as honest with me as he could be. But part of making a good apology, I think, is also making that apology somewhat public. And he never told his family. And I was incredibly close with his family. And so I lost all of those relationships because I didn't tell them. And so I think, I don't know, I definitely meandered away from your original question. I can't even remember what it was now.
Same.
But no, but he recently sent me an email. He has a copy of the book. I don't think he's read it yet. I'm curious to see what he thinks. But he said, if his family reads it, so be it. I told him, because I didn't change any details. I mean, I changed his name. I don't specify what city he's in. But if his family reads this, hears about the book and reads it, they will definitely know it was him. And but he's not going to take that extra step and tell them. And for me, that's part of what makes a good apology, is not just keeping it private. I wanted to see him follow that through because I think I want to believe he's still a good person.
But it sounds like he doesn't believe he's a good person.
He doesn't. And then that's where it came in, where I like reassured him. No, I think you're such a good person. We just made one mistake. And I don't think he doesn't think he's a good person. And he said by no means was the rape the only reason he hasn't been in a romantic relationship. But certainly, like, he no longer thinks of himself as one of the good guys. He did ask me if he could call himself a feminist. I was like, sure. Like, I don't know. I mean, like, that's up to
you.
Like,
people. Did you say the correct term actually is pro-feminist male? But go on.
Yeah. I think people are capable of change. And so, sure, if he wants to be a feminist, great. But I don't know. I think part of that is him taking full responsibility for what he did.
Do you think that a guy who does something like this and feels bad about it, but doesn't make the necessary like apology, like you're saying, like making an apology not to just the person, but maybe to other people who should know, right? Like public, whatever that means, right? Do you think that that guy should be allowed to call himself a feminist?
I mean, I'm not going to tell. I'm not the, you know, the feminist police, so I'm not going to tell him if it's going to be.
Or do you think that that's performative?
I mean, I think some of it might. It may very well be performative. I mean, I think if he and I were to have a conversation now about it, because some of it, like when having a conversation in the moment, because I slipped so easily into comforting him, I think I wanted to be supportive. But in retrospect, kind of like with the transcripts, when I reflect on what I said, I think about how, well, I should tell him that I do believe he should tell his parents before he can call himself a feminist, right? Because I don't think he offered a sufficient apology. And yet it's complicated because I'm a writer, and what he, by him answering my questions and agreeing to participate, it was helpful to me. I mean, writing is how I work through what I, not necessarily for catharsis, but I'm just like trying to figure out what do I think and how do I feel about a particular topic. And so his participation was incredibly helpful to me. So there is a way in which I told him I was grateful, and he's like, you can be grateful for it, but you don't have to be grateful to me. And so
yeah,
that
he really
was,
does hate himself.
Oh yeah, he does.
Wow. I have a really hard time with male feminists sometimes.
Yeah.
Just that whole idea of like, well, it's just this idea of like, I did this thing. I don't want anybody to know about it, or at least anybody who could have an opinion about me. You know what I mean? But I still want to call myself a good guy. Do you know what I mean? I want to look good, but I don't actually want to do the work to be good.
Sure. I mean, that's why I wrote the book, is because, like, that dude in an Elizabeth Warren shirt, he might have raped someone. We shouldn't just assume that, like, a guy who seems like an ally is innocent.
Right.
Right. But you don't, so you don't, like, do you feel it's always perform? It sounds like you feel like it's.
We at the show here do not like the term male feminist. Yeah. Naz and me both, we're kind of, we think it's just kind of like this thing that guys do to, like, we think that it's a means of co-opting the feminist movement. At least I don't know necessarily her exact reasoning. I shouldn't speak for her, but I think that. I personally think that by going, I'm also a feminist, that's another way that men, specifically white men, like, move themselves to the front of a conversation that they maybe are welcome to be a part of, but they should certainly not be at the head of the table. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, sure. I think sometimes we can get so hung up on a term and what are we allowed to, terms are useful, but, like, what are we allowed to call something or someone and what aren't we allowed? And I think in a way those terms are useful, but then it can be productive then to just think about the actions. Like, what do we want from people? Not necessarily just because someone calls himself a male feminist doesn't mean he's intentionally performing, right? Like, totally. he just might not know that it could be offensive to someone. So I think, like, terms are useful, but then in a way they can obscure the more nuanced aspect of something.
I completely agree. Which is honestly, though, like, the reason I agree is also one of the reasons I don't like the term. Because, like, I think that the term gets in the way of the action, right? Which is, like, if I go around telling people I'm a feminist, but I'm not doing anything, then people are going to think I'm a feminist whether or not I'm doing anything. Do you know what I mean? Whereas I believe in just, like, dropping any term like that and just being like, I'm just a nice dude, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just not a jerk is what I try to be. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you want to talk about?
I think the one thing I do want people to take away from the book, or what I want them, maybe not take away is the right term, but I want them to see how important the female friendships are to this book, because it does really become a book about female friendships and how they supported me throughout my writing of this and having conversations with them and them reading the transcripts and having their own suggestions and analysis. And so I just think about how important a support network is. That is something I hope people notice about. I hope readers notice about the book.
There's something that happens when we communicate externally, right? Whether it's writing something down or talking to someone about it, or just, I mean, honestly, just praying about it, whether you believe in God or the universe or whatever. There's something that happens when we, like, put a thought outside of ourselves. And it's obviously it's even better when there's a person there to rebound that in a similar fashion. Man, I love support groups, support networks, men's groups, women's groups, whatever. That stuff's awesome.
So that was Dan chatting to Jeannie Venasco about her new book, Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl. I'm Naz.
I'm Dan. Extremely glad you listened. Our co-producers are Jonathan Blackwell and Sam Baker, and we will be back next week. Please write to us and share this and tell everybody how great we are. Thanks. Bye.